Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. Some conservatives in our region say efforts to hand over parcels of federal land to states isn't enough. They want to see most federal land go to states.
By the letter of the law, the supreme law of the land, the U.S. Constitution, Congress is required to dispose.
A new study says the abortion pill, mifepristone, is more dangerous than previously known. Wyoming lawmakers shared the study on social media, but how do we know if it's true?
The authors don't provide enough information for us to evaluate their methodology, how they did the analysis, their data source.
Over half of Wyoming's school districts have now adopted a four-day school week.
I do think it's a good sign in that they're looking for ways to engage students.
Those stories and more, stay with us. This is Open Spaces.
Are you looking for a way to get involved with Wyoming Public Radio? Sign up for our new volunteer platform. Visit our website and click the volunteer button at the top to get started.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadelska. Feeding Laramie Valley is a nonprofit that, like many others, is feeling the heat under the Trump administration's cuts to grant funding, DEI efforts, and AmeriCorps. The federal agency sends volunteering youth to help out with public lands and communities across the state. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger, who once worked for Feeding Laramie Valley, paid a visit to talk with staff and volunteers to see how they're handling the fast pace of cuts.
Frankie Thorne is helping prep and pack something called shares bags.
It is a bag with 8 to 10 servings of produce per family household. We deliver to about 120 households, which is about 300 people overall. This is every week.
Thorne is an employee of Feeding Laramie Valley, a nonprofit with the mission of providing quality fruits and vegetables to people who are food insecure, often with food grown or purchased locally. They run a mobile food market, host a free summer lunch program for kids, as well as care for small community gardens and a farm on the southern end of Laramie. In previous years, Feeding Laramie Valley had teams dedicated to each program. Nowadays, Thorne is often riding solo.
No, it used to be done by like 3 to 4 staff members, but now we completely rely on volunteers for packing the bags.
Gail Woodsum has headed up Feeding Laramie Valley for a little over a decade. When Trump won last year, she knew they were in for changes.
So the surprise is the level at which changes are happening.
Those changes started with Trump's executive order banning diversity, equity, and inclusion, a huge focus of Woodsum's work.
We had to go through every grant contract, application, training manual, anything we had related to AmeriCorps, and wipe out any language that was contrary to these executive orders.
For Woodsum and the staff at Feeding Laramie Valley, the big question was, do we change the mission?
I called a special meeting and I said, we're being challenged here. We're being asked to do this, and I need your input.
For 2 days, the staff talked about their options. Do we compromise our values? Do we rewrite everything? Do we take a stand? For Feeding Laramie Valley, the decision was unanimous. Do what's needed to keep serving thousands of people each year. Then, they lost the COVID-era health disparities grant. Then, the first email from AmeriCorps, which is basically a national volunteer program that's like the Peace Corps, but for here at home, saying all deployments were paused.
So they gave us a heads up. And I was like, this is interesting. I've never gotten a heads up like this before. And then it was a matter of maybe a few weeks, maybe a month, that we then got another letter from AmeriCorps, email from AmeriCorps, that said, as expected, here come the changes.
Those changes, the entire program was cut. Feeding Laramie Valley's 11 AmeriCorps volunteers wouldn't be coming this year.
All of a sudden, like, we didn't hear anything. We have no contact with any member of the region.
But two members of the original AmeriCorps team were already on their way to Laramie. An email announcing the program's demobilization told them it was over. They wanted to get back to work.
We had gotten confirmed that our team was coming to this project probably about 2 weeks before we got demobilized and sent home.
That's Gwendolyn Cooley from Seattle.
Our team leader was the one that kind of brought up this idea.
And that's Annika Lachlan from San Diego.
And so we just kind of cold emailed Gail and just said, like, hey, like, this is a really unfortunate time for everyone. We would love to still come serve and help out because obviously all these organizations are without a workforce now.
They're currently working with Feeding Laramie Valley for 6 weeks, helping Frankie Thorne pack those shares bags, among other projects. They both say they managed to work out housing and a living stipend, but they would have preferred everyone on their AmeriCorps team get the same chance.
It's a really good opportunity for people who want to try something like this, and I am very disappointed that it's been taken away.
Yeah, especially because it's all about service and also gaining money to further your education as well.
Despite eager volunteers and dedicated workers, they'll still need to raise money from the community or apply to new private grants to make up for lost federal funds. But Woodsum isn't deterred.
The trick is to keep moving forward until you can't. And that's what I do try to share with the staff. We're not going to be part of ending it.
Woodsum says Feeding Laramie Valley will be open this summer. She says it's time for community support, not condolences. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Jordan Uplinger in Laramie.
Another possible impact, a long-standing federal program that helps train the next generation of the conservation workforce, could be on the chopping block as a result of Trump's proposed budgets. The Wyoming Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit is led by 3 U.S. Geological Survey researchers. It's one of 43 across the country and is well known for its work on wildlife migration. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman talked to people close to the program who are concerned about what cuts could mean.
In a video from the Wyoming Migration Initiative, a blue helicopter flies through falling snow, a big orange bag hanging below it. As it gets closer to the ground, the camera zooms in on what's inside that bag, a blindfolded mule deer. A group works together to collar the deer, which then bounds away through a field of sagebrush. For almost 50 years, the Wyoming Co-op unit has helped with projects like this, which directly inform conservation and management policy in the state. Since the 70s, co-op researchers at UW have also advised more than 200 graduate and PhD students, including Niall Clancy. His PhD looked at how climate change will impact native stream fish in Wyoming and Montana.
As a guy with a PhD, I'm not just interested in kind of these ivory tower questions.
Clancy grew up in the co-op model, undergrad in Montana, master's in Utah, PhD in Wyoming.
What I'm interested in is actually helping these agencies figure out how to do conservation for fish and wildlife for needs that they identify.
That's how the model works. USGS scientists and university students partner with state wildlife agencies to tackle agency-specific issues. The federal government pays for the researchers' salaries, and the other partners pay the rest, almost double what the feds contribute.
So it's essentially on-the-job training in a lot of ways for these students.
Clancy had a postdoc lined up with the Idaho Co-op unit on a project trying to keep fish off the endangered species list. But then he got a call saying it was canceled because of the uncertainty around the program. He's worried that if the co-op researchers lose their funding, it'll make the job search even more difficult.
It basically destroys the chances of the next generation for becoming scientists.
John Organ was in charge of the co-op research units nationwide in the mid-2010s. He says the strength of the program is solving real-world problems and
training students to be cognizant of what agencies do and the kinds of problems that they are faced with.
He says the Wyoming co-op's work on migration has been monumental.
We can already see the benefits of that with road crossings, with land conservation, with working with ranchers, private landowners.
Steve Williams says when he was a wildlife biologist in Massachusetts, working with co-op researchers broadened his horizons.
I learned a lot from those folks. we made better decisions because we had better scientific information than if we were just trying to do it on our own.
He directed the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for 3 years. He was also a co-op student and says cutting the program could hurt the future pipeline of wildlife management leaders.
A number of those students that go through the co-op unit programs have moved into either state or federal agencies and worked their way up through the agency because of that exposure.
Tony Wasley is the president of the Wildlife Management Institute, which is the private partner of the National Co-op Program. He says the units have been a bit of a political football for a while.
Under the Clinton administration, they were moved from the Fish and Wildlife Service into the USGS. And during Trump's first administration, there was again a presidential budget that showed very little interest in maintaining the cooperative research units.
Wasley says Congress has intervened in the past and maintained the funding. He thinks the co-ops could survive through some sort of public-private partnership if federal funding disappears. But he says communication, or the lack thereof, will play a big role in the program's future.
Would it cut them off at the knees? Yeah, if things happen too quickly without warning, that it makes contingency planning really difficult, and the loss of that incredibly valuable science and those partnerships would be felt far and wide.
The USGS and Wyoming Game and Fish did not respond to questions about the co-op program. A UW spokesperson says the university values the co-op's work, but hasn't been informed about any upcoming terminations. As for the future, he says, we just don't know. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
Stay with us. Up next, we hear the argument that federal lands should be handed over to the state. This is Open Spaces.
Want to keep up with local news but can't have your radio on 24/7? That's where Wyoming Public Radio's email newsletters come in. Get all of the local and regional news you want in your inbox. You can choose if you want an update every day or a weekly roundup of our top stories, or both. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This time on The Modern West, we continue the story of the wolf incident in Pinedale. We hear what it was like for the newspaper editor to cover it by herself after her entire staff is laid off by her corporate publisher.
An employee for the Road and Bridge Department was saying that I'm a bitch on a witch hunt for a man's family.
Ghost papering. It's part four of our series, The Gray in Between. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. There's a lot of talk right now about selling off portions of federal land for housing or energy development, but some conservatives in our region advocate for the idea on a much larger scale, transferring most of the land to states. As Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach reports, they say the Constitution mandates it.
Let's see here.
Wyoming state lawmaker Bob Ide is wearing a black cowboy hat as he thumbs through binders and books that are sprawled across a table in his Casper office.
I've been immersed in this for 10 years.
By this, he means the U.S. Constitution and legal justifications that most federal lands shouldn't be federal. He thinks they should be handed over to states.
Just kind of always wondered, why do we still have all of these federal lands?
In Wyoming, the feds own almost half of the land, a trend that holds across the vast Mountain West.
I started learning more and more and understanding that by the letter of the law, the supreme law of the land, the U.S. Constitution, Congress is required to dispose.
Ide subscribes to a niche argument that Congress is obligated to hand over ownership of its land. In recent years, that line of thinking has gained traction among mostly conservatives who want to preserve the U.S.'s first principles. And there's an even wider audience who hasn't studied the Constitution like Ide, but have problems with how the government manages mineral leases or restricts ATVs on roads.
So there's a lot of frustration out in the West, I understand that.
Not all conservatives feel the same way, like U.S. House Representative Ryan Zinke of Montana.
I give an example as a hotel. If you don't like the management of a hotel, don't sell the hotel. change the management.
That's Zinke in front of the U.S. Capitol. He was among Republicans that recently killed an amendment in the upcoming federal budget bill that would have given Utah 11,000 acres of federal land, and Nevada 500,000 to address the housing crisis. Meanwhile, a federal task force continues to look at ceding some parcels. But people like Bill Howell in Hurricane Utah think those efforts are small potatoes, and people spend too much time on tiny battles.
Wait a minute, why are you worried about those roads, for crying out loud? They're not even supposed to own the land.
Howell's retired. When he's not tending to his backyard fruit orchard, he's writing the books in Ide's office. His argument rests on a constitutional doctrine about equal footing.
Every new state, including Wyoming, is specifically admitted into the Union on an equal footing with the original states.
Or what was once the 13 colonies out east, which now have very little federal land. Howell says states out west aren't on equal footing with them since they don't have the same amount of territorial sovereignty. He also points to the Constitution's property clause, which says Congress shall have power to dispose of U.S. territory.
So the powers given to the federal government were not suggestions. They were duties.
But people like Gregory Obloski disagree.
This really is empowering Congress rather than imposing a limitation on what Congress can do.
The Stanford Law School legal historian says there's roughly two centuries of precedent from courts and Congress that back this up.
Here, I think it's really important to stress, right? Like, those arguments lost. They were rejected.
He says all this land didn't even belong to states in the first place. It was occupied by Native nations, many of whom are worried they could lose access under state control. Conservation groups also say states can't manage more land and worry it could be sold to private interests.
I mean, what's to say the U.S. government isn't going to sell it off to the highest bidder?
Back in his office, Bob Ide is wearing a gold shiny belt buckle that says Honor Wyoming. He introduced a resolution in the state legislature this year demanding Congress hand over almost all federal land and make it state public land.
My oath that I swore to at the legislature was to obey and defend the Constitution, and that's what I'm trying to do.
His resolution failed by one vote. He plans to reintroduce it next year. But even if it passes, Congress could still choose to ignore it. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Casper.
Tune in next week to hear about how the state manages its land. It's always been hard to recruit and retain prison staff in the United States, but the most recent data from the U.S. Census Bureau show that in 2022, the number of people working for state prisons hit its lowest mark in over two decades. Only four states were lower staffed than Wyoming, which oversees five state facilities. The Marshall Project, a newsroom that investigates the criminal justice system, dug into these numbers to get a better understanding of how low staffing impacts safety and mental health for workers and inmates alike. Shannon Heffernan is a staff writer who worked on this project. She explained how they started digging into the numbers.
So actually, a few months ago, we did this project looking at the number of staff at correctional facilities, at prisons. And we looked into that because it's something that we pretty much almost universally hear about prison facilities, is that there's just not enough staff. And one of the interesting things about this topic is it's a complaint that you hear both from staffers and from incarcerated people. Because staffers, you know, they don't want to work extra overtime. They don't want to be overstretched. They want to have enough people to make their jobs easy. But incarcerated people, they're also dependent on correctional officers for all kinds of things, like getting out of their cell, right, to have yard time. I will also say this varies state to state in the data that we looked at, but this data also includes non-security staff in some states. So it could be possibly healthcare staff or counselors or administrators who are providing all kinds of services that a person might need if they're incarcerated.
How is the prison system affected by staff losses?
Well, on the side of incarcerated people, almost everything that happens inside a prison requires staff, right? People are inside cells in these locked facilities. So anything that's coming in and out or that you do needs staffers. So if there's not enough people on staff, you're not making your healthcare appointments. Your family can't visit you because there's not enough people to take people to the visiting rooms. You may not be leaving your cell to go outside or get a shower or getting your food or medication on time. So we're talking about really basic services that affect a person's quality of life. For the staffers inside, people work really long hours when there's not enough staff. They get overtime, and this is not voluntary overtime in many cases. This is mandated overtime. So you may do an 8 or a 12-hour shift and turn around and have to do it back-to-back. So people are losing sleep. That's going to make them grumpy. That's going to make them potentially more aggressive, right? Which is not what you want in a corrections environment. And people miss their families, right? This is going to have a effect that goes out into the community for both staffers and incarcerated people.
And how is the trend playing out in Wyoming?
Wyoming is interesting because it had about a 20% decline from 2019 to 2024. That puts it in the top five in terms of declines we see in staffing in prisons. It did, towards the end of that, start to see an uptick. There was a 3% increase from 2023 to 2024. And there have been some news articles covering, you know, that Wyoming's been recovering staff, and that's, you know, allowed them, Wyoming was shipping some of their prisoners out of state because their staffing was so low and so troubled, and they've been being able to bring some of those people back.
How does incarceration numbers play into all of this? My understanding is that there's a national trend of those numbers increasing in the past couple of years as prison staffing is decreasing.
Yeah, so I think this is super important that whenever you talk about staffing, you're also talking about the number of people who are incarcerated, right? And I think there's two reasons you think about that. The first is the more people you have, the more care that they need, right? So if this is happening at the same time where you're starting to see numbers increase, so if that's happening at the same time that you're losing staff, it's going to make the situation worse, right? And this is something I really want to emphasize. It's important we talk about that because when people hear about there not being enough staff, the immediate solution people think of is like, we need to hire more prison staff. We need to hire more correctional officers. And that is one lever. But there's another lever, which is you can let more people out, right? And there is a lot of data showing that people in prison are growing older. And we know from data that people age out of committing serious crimes in a lot of cases. So there are opportunities to release people in a way that data shows us doesn't cause an increase in crime. So you can talk about both those levers as a solution to the problem. And I think it's important to look at that whole picture.
And when we mentioned Wyoming numbers, there was that small uptick, and you talked about how Wyoming was supposedly sending prisoners outside of the state. Are you at all aware of maybe Wyoming was letting prisoners out or anything about how maybe why that's kind of going in a better direction maybe?
In terms of the staffers, what I can say is there was a pay increase, which is one way that states work to recruit officers. You did see that. I will say in talking to officers, pay is super important and something people talk about. But the number one thing I heard from folks is, you know, this mandated overtime and the high stress being an issue. And that creates a troubling problem because the more people that leave, the more mandated overtime that you get, the more people leave, and it creates this sort of spiral. So while pay is something that states can do, I think by itself, there's reason to be skeptical that that can do the job. You also need to look at two pieces if you're talking about increasing staffing. You need to look at hiring. How do we get more people in the door? But also, how do we retain them once they're here? What's happening that makes people not want to stay in the job?
Are you aware if this trend of prison staffing decreasing, if it's impacting rural states differently?
I'm not aware of anything that shows that rural states particularly have this issue, although I will say in terms of the top states, you have Georgia, North Carolina, Nevada, New Jersey, and Wyoming. So that's, you know, a mix of rural and urban. But one thing is, even in states that have more urban areas, like where I live in Illinois, you have Chicago, right? But most of the prisons aren't near Chicago. They're 6-7 hours away in some cases in deeply rural areas. And that is a struggle for hiring staff because there's not enough population. And it's especially hard when you're talking about hiring staff on the medical side, right? Because medical resources are already thin in terms of people who are there. And then you're trying to recruit them into this like particularly difficult environment to practice medicine in. So I definitely do think the urban and rural divide affects things.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Of course, thank you so much.
That was Marshall Project staff writer Shannon Heffernan speaking about the number of prison staff in Wyoming. How do you know if a scientific study was done according to scientific standards? We will learn up next on Open Spaces.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we cut through the distracting clutter in the week's news and get to what really matters.
It's sweet, but can we talk about the nipple rings?
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us as we take the shirt off the news and see what's under there every week on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday morning at 10 and Sunday afternoon at 4 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadelska. In late April, the Wyoming Freedom Caucus shared a new study on social media. It says over 10% of women who took the abortion pill mifepristone experienced things like sepsis or hemorrhaging within 45 days. When our State House reporter Chris Clements saw the study, it caught his attention. 10% is a lot bigger than 0.5%, which is the likelihood of complications currently listed on the label. So, what to make of a study that seems to upend years of accepted science? Clements talked to several researchers about what to look for when evaluating new research, but first, we talked to Marty Halverson.
The headline is, "Data suggests abortion pill complications are 22 times higher than previously reported."
Halverson is a former state lawmaker and president of Wyoming Right to Life. She cited the study during an interview with my colleague at the community center in Etna. Halverson claims it's one example of dangerous outcomes from taking abortion pills like mifepristone. The study was authored by the Ethics and Public Policy Center, a religion-centered advocacy group.
It made national news. I'm not surprised that NPR and Wyoming Public Radio didn't pick it up.
The findings led to headlines in news outlets like the Washington Post, which fact-checked it in an article, and the National Review, which called it a bombshell study.
It could change the FDA's assessment of the abortion pill mifepristone.
The largest known study of the abortion pill released today says taking the pills leads to a serious...
It also came up at a U.S. Senate committee meeting. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. wants a review of mifepristone, in part because of the new data, which was gathered from thousands of insurance claims.
And it's alarming, and clearly it indicates that, at very least, the label should be changed.
He's asked the Food and Drug Administration to look into reviewing the drug, but some in the scientific community are skeptical about the study's bottom lines. Rachel Jones is the principal research scientist for the Guttmacher Institute, a policy group that supports abortion access. After a colleague sent her the study, she says she began to notice some red flags.
The authors don't provide enough information for us to evaluate their methodology, how they did the analysis, their data source, and in turn, we can't determine whether the findings that they claim to came out of this study are legitimate or not.
Jones says it's also a problem the study wasn't peer-reviewed. That's when other people in the same field analyze a study to make sure it holds water. And Jones found another problem.
They say, oh, we measured prescriptions for mifepristone. Well, if it was provided for a spontaneous abortion, a miscarriage, was it included in this analysis?
Jones says mifepristone is not just used for medical abortions. It can be used to manage miscarriages, too, and a whole host of other issues. Even so, state lawmakers and anti-abortion figures like Halverson have been saying publicly that the study should be cause for concern. So how can everyday Wyomingites tell if a scientific study has flaws?
My name is Bethann Garaman-Merkel.
She's the director of the University of Wyoming's Science Communication Initiative. First and foremost, Merkel says there's a basic question people should be asking themselves when they see a headline about a study.
How much do I want to believe this? And if what you really want to do is believe it because it supports what you understand about the world or your values or your politics, then those are actually the things that you should probably be the most skeptical about.
Then Merkel says, find out where the study came from. Was it published in a peer-reviewed journal, or
is this a brand new journal that's been invented by a group that has an agenda?
Find out who funded the study and why. Of course, some Wyomingites might worry that establishment scientists or journals are biased against conservatives.
So if somebody feels skeptical about science, they're part of the process, really. We're all skeptical about the results of our science because we are trying to figure out answers to incredibly hard questions.
Science is about chipping away tiny answers to gigantic questions over decades and even centuries, Merkel says.
One single conclusion is rarely enough information to make a massive sweeping policy or medical treatment decision on.
If you have questions about a study or the scientific process, Merkel says professors at UW are happy to talk. Their contact information is available at directory.uwyo.edu. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Chris Clements.
The Hot Springs School District is the latest to approve a plan to adopt a 4-day school week starting next year, according to the Thermopolis Independent Record. It follows a trend that's now worked its way into over half of Wyoming's districts. Of the state's 48, 26 now have alternative schedules. But the model has pros and cons. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards discussed those with the chair of the Wyoming State Board of Education, Mark Mathern.
The legislature said that the board should come up with some rules and regulations regarding alternative schedules. And we've seen schedules, everything from a 4-day week, as you suggest, to maybe partial days or, you know, something like that. But in the end, it's crucial, it's required that the minimum number of hours are kept by the level of the school. So elementary, there has to be 900 hours of student contact time, middle school, 950, and high school, 1,000. Many of our students are involved in activities. We can have school on Friday, but if the basketball team and the wrestling team is gone, that's most of our boys or girls. That's just one example. I recently had a conversation with a retired school principal from a small school in Wyoming, and her comment was that the parents were all for the idea because many of them had children that were at the younger age and at the older age. And so they would often have to take their youngers out of school to go watch their olders play in the sport. And so not only did you have the one who was in the activity gone, but you had the younger gone because the family needed to travel. And so when they went to a 4-day week, for example, you know, the whole family could attend. Another concept that has come up is teachers and administrators are asking for time to spend with teachers around staff development. The other one I've heard is a specific time to focus on any kind of deficits that a student might have. Maybe they're working Monday through Thursday in just regular class, but on Friday, then students that are struggling or behind or need some additional support maybe would come in the morning on Friday and there would be one-on-one time. Some people call it when time, what I need time. But those are a few examples, Melody, of things I've heard of why a district or a school might go to a 4-day week.
I know that one of the questions about it is, well, what do those folks who have small children, how do they go to work? Or is that an additional cost for them to have to get childcare? And especially when we're having such a shortage of childcare across Wyoming, have you heard from any school districts where parents are worried about that?
In my experience in education, I have heard of some districts that will actually offer some sort of daycare activity or make an arrangement. I know in a smaller town, it might be a little more difficult, but, you know, make an arrangement with like a Boys and Girls Club type program or something like that, where there are special partnerships created for those days off where local agencies can assist.
Another benefit is that this is helping with teacher retention. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how school districts might be choosing this option as a way to make sure that teachers stay around and why teachers might prefer a four-day week.
I have not seen any data come back to the state board that says, because we've done this, we think our teachers are staying longer. As a matter of fact, from a research perspective in terms of student achievement, the results are mixed. A four-day week or a five-day week, we're not necessarily seeing the type of expectations that the teachers in the schools are setting, as well as the parents, of course.
I did come across one analysis, and it did include Wyoming, that kind of looked at whether this affected student performance. It looked like you said, that it was kind of a mix, because it said that there was some effect on reading skills, but that was mostly in larger towns, that it didn't really affect achievement in rural communities.
I don't know about that particular one. And quite frankly, my next question to you is going to be, did it improve them or did it make them worse? Because I don't know the difference. We know, for example, summer, the lack of focused education in the summer, that has an impact on reading and math. We know that, and it's a negative impact. So we know that length of time has a detriment. The other thing I would say is, when a school or a school district moves to a four-day week, there is some, what I would say, staff development components that really need to be in place. When one shifts from, let's say, a 60-minute block or a focus on reading, let's say, from at the elementary, 90 minutes a day to 120 minutes a day because you don't have reading on Friday, there has to be, I think, a study and a conversation about how does learning look when one has an additional 30 minutes of time. I'm a retired high school teacher. You can't just say, well, now instead of 20 minutes to do your homework for tomorrow, you now have 35 minutes or 40 minutes. That doesn't cut it. That doesn't take advantage of the fact that five lessons, if you will, need to now be done in 4 days instead of five. It means there has to be variability. There has to be a change up of what students are engaged in.
I wonder if you can kind of go into a little more detail about just what the state's, you know, guidance, maybe even rules are around the school districts. What help is the state offering?
They have to have a proposal, has to have some educational goals and purposes in it. There has to be some sort of method to evaluate whether it's achieved its goals. And there has to be two publicly advertised meetings. And part of it, from our perspective, is we want local districts to have the flexibility to educate the kids as they see beneficial to their community.
It sounds like the way that you're interpreting the fact that this is becoming something that a lot of districts are adopting, that to you is looking like school districts are trying to reimagine school and being creative about what that's going to look like and try things. So to you, it seems like it's a good sign.
I do think it's a good sign in that they're looking for ways to engage students, and those ways require a rethinking of the traditional classroom. And if the state board can help with that by providing ways to remove barriers around certain kinds of rules, you know, we want to be helpful with that.
Thank you so much. We have been speaking with Mark Mathern, who is the chair of the Wyoming State Board of Education. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you, Melody.
Home insurance is getting more expensive and in some cases harder to find as the risk of wildfire increases in the West. We'll hear about proposed solutions. That's coming up next on Open Spaces.
My name is Sarah Mikesell Growney. I live in Sheridan, Wyoming. Honestly, I am just a lover of the news. One of my very first childhood memories is da, 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 da. And I continue to take in all of it. It's so hard anymore to find balanced news where it's not just a bunch of people pontificating and throwing ideas out there that see if they stick. So I feel like I walk away from Wyoming Public Radio educated and ready to have any conversation. It's my most valued news source that I listen to or read, and why would I not pay for it? Thank God we have federal funding, but obviously every year or every new administration that's threatened, and it concerns me greatly. So I will donate. I will always donate. Quite frankly, it's my absolute most valued source of news, entertainment, you name it.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. We're starting to see wildfires pick up across the state. So we're going to spend the next few stories hearing about different ways land managers and homeowners are trying to shore up protections for their properties before we really get into the season. This first story takes us to a prescribed burn, where firefighters use fire intentionally to cut down the risk of unexpected burns. This has been happening across Wyoming all spring. The projects are labor intensive, and job and funding cuts at the federal level create uncertainty. Rocky Mountain Community Radio's Caroline Yanez tagged along with the U.S. Forest Service on a prescribed burn near Aspen to find out more.
Just minutes from some of the most expensive homes in Aspen, Colorado, federal crews are setting the hillside on fire, igniting the brush from a helicopter hundreds of feet in the air. Dan Nielsen, the fuels program manager for the White River National Forest, is the burn boss on this job. He says the primary reason for this fire is to improve winter habitat for elk and mule deer, but really, it's good for the whole ecosystem.
We burn a lot of the decadent, deadened down oak brush as well. So then we burn up that fuel, and then you have with the newer vegetation, it has more moisture in it, and it's more resilient for wildfire.
Fire has always been a natural part of the landscape in the West. But Laura D., a professor at CU Boulder, says human-caused climate change drives hotter, more severe wildfires, creating conditions completely new to ecosystems.
In some places, like conifer forests in the West, we're not seeing forests recover. They're turning into shrublands or just not coming back at all. And part of that is because the fires then burn hotter, they burn deeper in the soil, and they burn the cones and seed stock.
Prescribed burns, on the other hand, allow managers to facilitate low-intensity fires that do help the landscape. But prescribed fires are no small undertaking. Fire crews from the city of Aspen right here in town and as far away as the Four Corners in Utah are assisting on this burn. Nielsen says a prescribed fire is all hands on deck for the White River National Forest as well.
It's not just fire people. To pull these prescribed burns off, we have input from a lot of other disciplines, wildlife, soils, geez, even timber shop. There's a lot of different aspects that go into planning these projects just so we're not harming the overall forest there as well.
While this fire is unique because it's so close to private property, any prescribed fire is going to have its logistical challenges. That's according to Anna Lopresti, a PhD candidate in Dee's lab at CU Boulder.
The slope of the landscape, is it accessible? Will the Forest Service be using drones or will they be using hand tools? How many staff and red-carded folks would they need on the ground in order to get that burn done in the time that they have?
Red card is the nickname for an incident qualification card, which certifies someone to work on wildland fire crews across multiple federal agencies. And then, of course, there's the timing. Nielsen says wind, temperature, snow on the ground, and soil moisture all play a role in the perfect prescribed burn conditions.
Springtime in the Rockies, it could be snowing right now, you know, getting a powder day, or it could be 70 degrees and blowing wind and really blustery. So we're very fortunate to have this weather window we are having right now.
At the burn site, staff are constantly getting up-to-date weather conditions to determine the perfect time to ignite.
Clear skies.
5%.
There's also the helitac crew in the air doing primary ignition, as well as hand crews on the ground, maintaining fire lines and igniting small patches if necessary. All in all, that makes a little over 80 staff members on this one project alone. But the ability to carry out prescribed burns could be in jeopardy, with thousands of Forest Service workers laid off or taking early retirement under the Trump administration. The Forest Service says no firefighting positions were cut during a mass firing of probationary workers this winter. However, Lopresti says, cuts to other positions means less flexibility for the agency when it needs to manage mitigation and active fires.
That type of moving around gets a lot trickier when staff are getting cut and also when funding is getting cut. It makes it difficult to pay people overtime and it makes it difficult to pay people to come from one unit to another.
The Forest Service says it doesn't have a number on how many cuts affected workers with red cards, but Colorado lawmakers estimate that number is around 3,000 across the agency, with another round of job cuts likely coming to agencies like the Forest Service. And, as Nielsen says, hiring for wildland fire jobs has always been a challenge.
Every year it's a moving target, how many people you get, and just hiring in general is difficult.
But for now, this piece of the Rockies near Aspen will get the benefits of fire, as new vegetation moves to fill in burned areas, hopefully strengthening the landscape far into the future. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Caroline Yanez.
Unintentional fires have been a big reason why home insurance rates are rising across the West. One of the most important causes is climate change-fueled wildfires. Recent federal data show insurance companies aren't renewing policies for homeowners in many places, and annual premiums are jumping hundreds of dollars from one year to the next. For example, in Teton County, non-renewal rates jumped from 0.25% to 3.74% in 5 years, one of the sharpest jumps in the West. The Mountain West News Bureau's Murphy Woodhouse takes us to a rural Idaho community that's been particularly hard hit.
It's an unseasonably warm spring weekday in the rural Idaho town of Crouch, an hour drive north of the capital, Boise. Cars pass slowly by the Dirty Shame, a popular restaurant and watering hole. The middle fork of the Payette River meanders a few hundred yards away, just shy of where it meets the main branch in the stunning Garden Valley. High and thick mountains rise many hundreds of feet in all directions.
What a beautiful day to come to Crouch.
Yeah.
I'm there to meet Sandy Nabefeld and her husband Dave, both in their 70s. Sitting in the shade on the bar's front porch, Sandy, a former Boise nurse, explains they bought a lot nearby in 1990.
Thinking that after we retired, we would come up to Garden Valley and make that our home.
For several decades, their property was insured without issue. But then, 5 or so years ago, they received notice that their policy would not be renewed.
It was shocking. It was like, oh my God, all of our investment here in this house. What are we going to do, Dave?
The first emotion is anger. So why can they do this to us, you know? We paid our bills on time for years and years.
They say their insurer told them the decision was based on wildfire danger in the area. With the help of an independent agent, the couple found a new policy, this time with auto owners. But in June 2023, another letter came.
You are hereby notified in accordance with the terms and conditions of the above reference policy that the insurance provided by such policy will cease.
The letter explained auto owners was also trying to reduce its wildfire exposure. A company spokesperson did not respond to a list of questions regarding the cancellation.
I wanted to deck somebody.
For a second time, they turned to their insurance agent and found a third policy. But after two non-renewals,
I'm afraid, you know, that I'm going to get a third letter.
More and more such letters have been arriving in surrounding Boise County. In 2023, nearly 1 in 30 policies were not renewed, the highest rate in the state, and triple what it was in 2018. Colorado, Montana, New Mexico, and Wyoming all have multiple counties whose rates at least tripled. That's according to data released by the U.S. Senate late last year as a part of a probe into what it called the climate change-driven homeowners insurance crisis. A major recent analysis from the U.S. Treasury's Federal Insurance Office found that the West had some of the sharpest premium jumps. The FIO identified several key factors behind these trends, including rising rebuilding costs, continued development in high-risk areas, and increasingly common and severe climate-fueled disasters like wildfires.
They should be very worried.
And not just rural Boise County residents like Sandy and Dave, says Idaho Insurance Commissioner Dean Cameron.
We're hearing those kind of complaints from all over.
And if nothing is done to address it,
it will continue to spiral in the wrong direction. And the spiral gets wider and wider.
The retirement home that Sandy and Dave dreamed into being is a stately log structure, a short walk from the Terrace Lakes Resort's 18th fairway. Dave built it with the help of two others.
How many hours did you personally put into building this home?
Thousands.
The retired Boise firefighter has taken a number of measures to keep the home safe. It has a metal roof, and drain rock forms a non-combustible ring around the structure. There's a fire hydrant up front.
And there's another one on the back. It's got 100 pounds of pressure.
Insurance or no, the couple intends to live out their remaining years in the home.
You have to prepare yourself.
And if the flaming front ever comes, he says he's ready to do whatever it takes to protect it. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Murphy Woodhouse.
We just heard how homeowners can take steps to mitigate fire risk around their houses, but lawmakers in Rocky Mountain states are also thinking bigger. Some are proposing reforms to make sure homeowners stay insured. The Mountain West News Bureau's Rachel Cohen shares how state leaders are trying and struggling to get reforms passed.
A stone's throw from the Colorado Capitol early this spring, Michael Conway was preparing to make a case to lawmakers. He's the state's insurance commissioner.
Something bad has probably happened in your life if you know what the state insurance commissioner is.
Conway insures companies providing car, health, and home insurance are following the law. It's an under-the-radar but vital role, especially as disasters like hailstorms and wildfires hit our region more often. More than 3 years ago, over 1,000 homes burned in the Marshall Fire, the most destructive in state history. And since, Colorado's home insurance market has never been more shaky.
We have insurance companies that are making decisions to not write throughout the entire state like they were previously.
Homeowners are freaking out.
Douglas Heller is an advocate with the Consumer Federation of America. He says people all over the West are paying more for insurance if they can find coverage at all.
So they're calling up their lawmakers. They're calling anybody who will listen and saying, what do I do?
Some state leaders are hearing their calls. A Mountain West News Bureau review found at least 13 bills introduced in 7 state houses in our region this year that try to tackle this issue. Some would clarify how insurance companies assess risk, and others would make communities more resilient to blazes. Conway's first fix came a few years back when Colorado set up a state-backed insurance safety net for people turned down by private companies.
If you can't find insurance coverage, you don't have the ability to buy or sell a home.
The program went live last month and people are signing up, but Conway says it's not enough.
Commissioner Conway, welcome to the House Finance Committee. Please state your name, who you're representing. You have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, Chairman Lindstedt, members of the Finance
Committee. So he went back to lawmakers with an idea for how to make insurance more affordable. The big bill, as he calls it, is complicated. One part would set up a state fund to absorb one of the fastest growing costs for insurance companies, the insurance they buy on the global market.
We want to take on part of the risk of the wildfire events that happen in Colorado and offset those insurance costs for our homeowners.
And he had the support of Governor Jared Polis in this year's State of the State address.
Just as Lord of the Ring fans know that one does not simply walk into Mordor, one does not simply fix homeowners insurance. But we need to start somewhere, and we need to start now.
But some state leaders worry too much regulation could scare off insurers. Carol Walker with the Rocky Mountain Insurance Association says it's not an empty threat.
We want to stay in your state. We want to sell insurance. But if we have to gamble on us being able to pay out claims, that's not a risk that we can take.
Her group initially opposed the bill in Colorado, and it ended up dying. Lawmakers were wary that the plan required homeowners to pay an upfront fee before they'd see any potential savings. Senator Judy Amable was one of the bill sponsors and called the defeat a disappointment.
We're now opting to do nothing about a runaway freight train that is going to hit all of us.
But even over in Idaho, where Conway's counterpart tried a more conservative approach, they also came up short.
Unfortunately, we've got some work to do. with the legislature?
Idaho Insurance Commissioner Dean Cameron proposed a grant fund to help residents prevent their properties from burning in wildfires. But the proposal failed. So did a resolution just to study the issue.
We have to help them understand why this isn't an expansion of government.
Some efforts did have success in Mountain West state houses. A separate bill in Colorado could give property owners more credit for wildfire mitigation. Another in New Mexico paves the way to certify properties as wildfire prepared. But the majority of measures we reviewed failed. Conway and Cameron say they'll be back in front of lawmakers next year, worrying that without solutions, the problem will just get worse. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Rachel Cohen.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Ivy Engel, our audio producer and digital producer today, and Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.